President Donald Trump has issued a series of executive orders targeting DEI programs, declaring them wasteful and discriminatory, and Ohio lawmakers have targeted DEI too. Is it worth fighting to keep diversity programs, or is there another better way to address racial injustice? A new book called Who Pays for Diversity? Why Programs Fail at Racial Equity and What to Do About It argues such programs often end up causing harm to the very people they purport to help, employees of color. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Author Onia Fennell Okwabi will discuss her book June 3rd at the Mercantile Library in Cincinnati. She joins me now in this recorded interview. Thanks so much for being here, Onia.
It's a pleasure.
It's great to have you. I think many of us who work in professional settings have taken part in diversity programs of some kind. Based on your research, what are some of the things these programs get wrong?
These programs are, for the most part, well-intended. But what they tend to do is focus on the external appearance of diversity instead of what it is employees of color really need to succeed. And so in the process, they end up heaping additional work burdens on employees of color to represent diversity so that workplaces can claim to be diverse. And in the process, employees of color end up doing two jobs instead of the one job they've been hired for.
Two jobs and one paycheck.
Exactly.
Yeah. You interviewed dozens of people of color and found that for the most part, these diversity policies made their difficulties in the workplace worse instead of better. Is that all about the two jobs for one paycheck, or is there more to it than that?
Yes, there's more to it. So I found three primary outcomes of the key issue of diversity programs, which is commodification. When you take employees of color and you use them in order to portray your workplace as something, in this case, authentically diverse, that ends up creating three additional burdens on employees of color. Heavy work burdens, I just mentioned, doing two jobs for only one paycheck. But in addition to that, there's a thing that we call threatened legitimacy, which just means you see what your workplace is portraying on the outside, and you also see what's happening on the inside. And the difference between those two creates feelings of guilt in you. You're not quite sure if your employer is doing the right thing, but you're part of that. And so that creates a feeling of guilt for you. Also, we've heard this barbed insult being thrown around, diversity hire or DEI hire. These are very highly qualified folks who are faced with this insult day in and day out. And so they work extra hard so that nobody has any credible reason to throw this insult at them. And this happens because diversity programs are framed as somehow a gift to employees of color instead of a way to remedy past discrimination. And then finally, there are issues with identity, where employees of color are forced into the sort of identity that allows their company to portray diversity instead of being able to be themselves in work.
You mentioned commodification. I thought that was a really interesting part of your book. Can you give us some examples of how that happens? You have real life examples throughout your book.
Yeah, absolutely. Commodification can look like a lot of things. I think we've all laughed about the diversity photo, where you see a photo from an organization and there's one white person and one black person, one person who appears to be Muslim and an Asian person, and they've been all put together in this package to portray a certain image. Well, that seems relatively harmless in isolation, but imagine being drawn into those photos again and again and again. Beyond just being pictured in a photo, imagine being brought to a meeting where you are not in charge of the client for whom the meeting is for, but you're being asked to be there because the client shares your racial identity. And so once again, that's taking away time from what it is that you plan to do. Imagine being hired at a company, well-qualified, deserve to be there, but you learn after your hiring that you were hired because the company has recently been accused of racism. Those stories were true for many of the people in my book.
Can people end up being pigeonholed as if their most important contribution to their workplace is their race? Is that part of it?
100%. There were folks who had been hired into roles that had a lot to do with diversity. And when they decided that they would like to switch or do something else, they did not find those avenues available to them. They also felt like they couldn't get away from service on the diversity committees or any of those things that constitute that extra job without experiencing negative sanctions at work. So really not able to be all that they were qualified to be in the workplace.
We've talked a little bit about the impact of these programs on employees of color, but conservative critics of these programs typically focus on the perceived costs to white men. What do you think is going on there?
Well, there's a lot of things going on there. but what I will say is, again, with the way that diversity has been framed to be about we are all together and we are all learning from each other. But that's really a benefit to white folks, the idea that we can all be together and you can learn from these diverse perspectives. And so if diversity is framed this way, if that's the key benefit of diversity, and you no longer want that benefit, then it stands to reason to say, well, why would I want this program around? This is taking away a spot for me for a benefit I don't even want, which is why it's so important that we get back to understanding why these programs were created in the first place. They were created in the first place because we have a serious issue with job discrimination. Studies show that job discrimination against Black applicants has not improved since 1989.
1989.
And so the idea that we've gotten to a point where anybody who walks in the door with their resume is being considered on an equal basis is just not true. But that is what the popular belief is. And so that allows this focus on the backlash of white males against diversity programs instead of understanding what diversity programs could really do if they were focused on racial equity instead of just the appearance of diversity.
We're talking in this recorded interview about a new book called Who Pays for Diversity? Why Programs Fail at Racial Equity and What to Do About It. So who benefits most from these programs, Onia?
Workplaces benefit most from these programs. So they have the opportunity to get qualified candidates in the door because through these programs, they are able to hire employees of color who add to their bottom line. They're also able to portray themselves as diverse through the additional work of these employees of color, which boosts their reputation in terms of the markets. Studies have previously shown that companies that are able to portray themselves as diverse show a bump in terms of investments. They're also able to reach out to clients and customers of color, again, through the often uncompensated work of these employees of color. So this is a huge benefit to workplaces. And I simply believe those benefits should be shared with the employees who are doing the work so that those benefits accrue to the companies.
Yeah. We've talked some about the price, really, that employees of color pay for these programs, this extra work, the commodification, the sometimes tokenization that employees go through. And for a number of the people you interviewed for your book, this made them physically ill, right?
Absolutely. Stunningly, and it was stunning to me, honestly, even though I knew this was an issue. In the book, I talked to pastors, professors, and corporate professionals. 9 out of 10 of the pastors and professors I talked to had either serious emotional or physical signs of stress as a result of their commodification in their workplaces. These included having symptoms of stroke, having insomnia, headaches, being short with their families. For corporate professionals, it was a little bit better, but not much. 3 out of 4 of the employees I spoke to were experiencing these symptoms. And I did not recruit for folks who are experiencing symptoms of stress. This was just the outcome of what they told me was their commodification in their workplaces.
Wow. And how did you recruit people to talk to for this book?
Various ways. I had some marvelous undergraduate research assistants get on LinkedIn and start reaching out to people for interviews. I also asked folks who I interviewed if they would be willing to recommend other people. But clearly because employees of color are already at risk in their workplaces, it was important to me to make sure that I concealed their identities, protected their identities so that they were free to tell me their stories.
And just to be clear, we've probably already said this, but you were talking to employees from various racial and ethnic backgrounds. This wasn't just African-American employees or Black or, you know, there was lots of different people you talked to.
That's right. I spoke to Black, Latinx, and Asian-American employees across churches, universities, and corporations.
Yeah. We just talked about all the stress so many of these employees are under, but even despite that, many employees of color find themselves giving back to other employees of color, even if it hurts their own advancement or work-life balance. Talk to us about that.
Yes, that is a happening that I call diversity as philanthropy. It's the way that employees of color that I talked to made sense of their presence in these workplaces. And they made sense of their presence in these workplaces being to give back to students, in the case of professors, or congregants in the case of pastors, or other employees in the case of corporate professionals. And so outside of what their employers have asked them to do, outside of what they would get credit for in their annual reviews, they took time out to mentor these folks because they believed, why am I here if not to give back to the next generation, if not to make the people coming up behind me better than myself? But what often gets missed, people seem to assume, of course they're going to do that. But what often gets missed is that that investment of time and energy often came at the expense of what they needed to do for their own career advancement. And so what I'd love us to do is to stop thinking about that sacrifice as just, oh, of course you're going to do that, but as a real sacrifice, as a real act of philanthropy.
You talked about a wealth manager in your book who really focused on giving time to anybody who needed advice, even if they didn't have a lot of money to invest. And that literally takes money out of his pocket.
It absolutely does. So the wealth manager you're speaking of, I named him Eodeli Marshall. That's not his real name. But he was a college student, had managed to scrap and save up $1,000 and went to a wealth manager hoping to invest it. And the person ignored him, didn't give him the time of day, spent 15 minutes on his account. Years later, he looked back and he had made pennies. And he promised himself that that would never happen to anybody who came to him. And so even though his white counterparts had minimums of, I'm not going to meet with you unless you have $250,000, he would meet with anyone who wanted to meet with him, even though his company would not pay him for those amounts if they were below a certain amount. So Marshall wants to raise to the highest levels of his company, but he's competing against people who are only spending their time on these larger accounts. And so he is giving up an avenue for his own advancement in order to make sure that people have a wealth manager to talk to who looks like them.
If so many companies are doing this wrong with these diversity programs, these DEI programs, what should they be doing instead?
Instead of focusing on diversity and hoping that we will eventually get to racial equity by changing the numbers game, why not just focus on racial equity? What is it that your employees of color need to be successful and fill those gaps? And that only happens by listening. There are assessments that workplaces can put in place to understand what each population of their employees need and put in place changes to those. And some of these are minor changes, honestly, that just require a perspective shift towards racial equity. One example I gave was thinking about mentoring programs. So often mentoring programs become an additional burden of time because you're paired up with somebody that you don't really have a relationship with. What if instead workplaces said, hey, mentoring is important to us. You find your own mentor. We're going to give you some training on how to make sure you found the right mentor. And then we're going to fund that relationship by providing you funds to meet with that mentor, as well as providing a stipend to the mentor for their time.
Wow, that kind of blows my mind. Have you run into any company that does it that way?
Very seldom.
What are ways that in the book you talk about churches, you talk about universities, you talk about workplaces, you talked about mentoring just now in a workplace. What would an effective change look like in a church setting or a university setting?
Yeah. So in a church setting, and I actually give a story in the last chapter of the book of an employee who's working in an effective church setting. And what was true for her was that her senior pastor, who was a white man, was taking the hits around diversity and race and was a vocal advocate of racial justice in the congregation so that she didn't have to be the person for all things racial, so that she wasn't taking those targeted things. Also, that as a result of that, she was just able to do her job description as an assistant pastor. She was able to spend her time preparing sermons instead of preparing a curriculum around race, unless she wanted to. In a university setting, we know that professors of color face all sorts of challenges, including lower student evaluations relative to their quality of teaching and lower opportunities to receive grant funding, both of which have been under attack recently. And so recognizing some of these things and correcting them.
Yeah. Did you find any workplaces doing this right?
Unfortunately, these workplaces were few and far between. And again, most of the places doing these programs have good intentions, but they have not spent the time to understand what it is that their programs are doing and how to get the results that they actually say that they want.
You're in academia now. You're an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Cincinnati, but yes. You've had other careers in the past. Mm-hmm. What's been your experience in this kind of diversity program world? I mean, what have you experienced yourself?
So everything that is in this book has felt so very true to me. And I think that is one of the reasons it was so rewarding to talk to people and to hear their stories, because their stories are my story. I've also done work in churches. And as you mentioned, I'm now in academia. So all three of the workplaces in this book, I have experience in. My experiences have been similar in so many ways. I talk about at one point before I became an academic, I was eyeing a career change into full-time ministry. And as a woman, I had a difficult time finding my way into a full-time position there. But one way that I was able to actually get invitations to come speak was on a speaker on diversity. And so that's where my racial qualifications outweighed my gender disqualifications in the church. When I worked in corporate, I was on diversity committees basically from 6 months after I entered the company until 14 years later when I left. And the funny thing was, I was at an incredibly data-driven company, a very good company, but the sociological research on what works in diversity programs, I didn't even know it existed until I left corporate for academia. Mm.
In your book, you write about the U.S. Supreme Court case, Students for Fair Admissions versus University of North Carolina, and what Justice Clarence Thomas said about that case. Then you write, quote, "Given challenges like this playing out on a national stage, it feels risky to expose the negatives of diversity as I have done in this book. I am wary of my words being used by conservative critics of diversity to fight for a world in which racial disparities are ignored," end quote. Talk a little bit about what Justice Thomas said and how you hope this book and your words are used.
Yes. So Justice Thomas, as he has continued to be, was very dismissive of diversity and the benefits of diversity. Demographic diversity, I want to be clear, more so than diversity programs. I have been concerned that people might look at this and say, well, she says diversity doesn't work, so we don't have to do it anyway. But the idea is not to replace diversity programs with nothing. The idea is to replace them with what actually works. Wouldn't we like to get to a place where we don't have to take race into consideration because it's no longer an issue? We're not experiencing disproportionate job discrimination, that our front offices look like the populations of people that are around us. We're honestly nowhere near that point. And so in order to get to that place, we need to be honest about our historic discrimination, about continuing discrimination, and then put in place plans that can actually address the challenges that employees of color are facing.
Well, I've been talking with University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor of Sociology, Onea Fennell. Okwabi. Her new book is called Who Pays for Diversity? Why Programs Fail at Racial Equity and What to Do About It. She'll be discussing her book June 3rd at the Mercantile Library in Cincinnati, and you can find a link with more information on our website, wvxu.org. Thank you so much for your time today, Onia, and for this terrific book.
Glad to do it.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical directors are Marshall Verbsky and Carlos Lopez-Cornu. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.